The following is a rebroadcast of Straight Talk About Money. The market data in this rebroadcast is not current and should not be used for any financial decisions.
Well, if you watch CNBC or many of the other cable programs that have to do with financing, there's no doubt that you've seen this gentleman. Our guest today is senior columnist for Yahoo Finance, Mr. Michael Santoli. He appears not only on CNBC, but he appears on the Daily Ticker and the Hot Stock Minute on Yahoo Finance, where he offers insights on the most important business stories of the day. He was 15 years as a columnist and feature writer for Barron's Magazine. He received two Dow Jones Newswires Awards for Distinguished Real-Time Journalism. And we are honored today to have with us today, Michael Santoli. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, first of all, I guess I just kind of ask you, what do you think of what's going on out there? We have a lot of volatility. The market seems to be going up and down. There doesn't seem to be a lot of direction. There's a lot of argument about where the Fed is going. Are they going to raise rates? Are they not going to raise rates? Do you have some general thoughts on what do you think this year is going to look like? A lot of prognosticators out there are pretty much saying we're not going to be in for a very exciting year in the markets. What do you think?
Yeah, you know, that it does seem to be the way people are kind of defaulting to this idea that maybe it's kind of sideways or not too much on either side. I do think it's interesting the way the year started. We finished 2014 at an all-time high with a lot of optimism that things would continue into the coming year and that interest rates would go up. And, you know, it's very similar, by the way, to the way 2013 ended. And guess what? January went the same way. We had a kind of a quick gut check. I think what happened really here this year was, you know, the equity market was just having to absorb and digest all that volatility in the oil market. And, of course, with the huge rally in the dollar, people were trying to figure out exactly where that was going to stop and what it meant for earnings and everything else. So once that calmed down in February, it's like we took it all back. So I kind of feel as if, we haven't really done much, even though it has chopped around quite a bit, especially in January and into the beginning of February. You know, I look at the market now, if we get down around under 2100 on the S&P 500, well, on December 30th, we were at 2090. So really not a whole lot has happened, and the action has been overseas. You know, overseas markets rallying, in at least in their currency terms. And it seems as if I was thinking we're in for a year when maybe the U.S. economy and consumer do a bit better than the equity market after a few years of actually having the reverse be the case.
In fact, you wrote an article about chasing European stocks but avoid the euro. What do you think investors should do with regard to Europe? Should they be investing in the euro? Should they be buying into European stocks instead of buying in here in the States?
It's interesting because that piece focused on the fact that there was this rush for people to play the European stock rally, but they're doing it through ETFs where you hedge out the euro exposure. So basically people say, well, I want to own that recovery potential, but I don't want to be subject to a euro, which, of course, the entire world thinks is going to be worth less. And
right.
When everybody thinks it's going to be worth less and they're hedging it too much, does that mean, in fact, that's the right trade? So that was the question I was raising. I do think you want exposure over there. You're actually seeing the growth numbers pick up. We had a lot of time. You know, it reminds me of the way it was with QE2 over in the States here, where there was deep skepticism that the actual economic fundamentals would respond. And kind of just as QE was starting here, we happened to be at a point when the pendulum was swinging back toward a growth phase in the economy, and it seems like maybe that's going on in Europe, helped by lower oil and the cheaper euro for the moment. So I do think it makes sense to have exposure there, but if you want it for the global diversification effect, hedging away the currency, it seems to me you have to be right both ways if you have that
right.
As your call. You have to be right that the market does well, and you have to be right that that currency is going to go the way you expect.
Absolutely. And it's a tough call to make one. To have to make both those calls just makes it much more difficult. In terms of, it looks like we're getting a quantitative easing in Europe. And everybody, you know, there's a lot of talk, and has been for years, that that the asset price increase in the United States in stocks has been directly associated with the monetary policy and the quantitative easing and the money coming into the economy via the Fed. And I've seen charts to that effect also. It looks like we're starting that now in Europe. So a lot of people are saying, hey, you need to go invest in Europe because they're going to do the same thing over there that we did over here. Is that what you think is going to happen?
You know, I don't think it's as direct a call to make in that regard. Here's why. you know, over here, it's sort of the jury's out exactly to how much of the rally in equity markets and the strength in the credit markets has been directly a result of the dollars created by QE. I do think the message sent by QE, which is central banks are going to wait for the economy to respond, they're going to try to do everything they can to support growth, that helped the markets. But I think mostly in the earlier phases is when it helped the most, and that was when the credit markets were not all that healthy, and basically you had very high, you know, spreads between low-grade credit and high-grade credit, and that's what really was helped by QE. I mean, when that flushes into the system, you're taking risk-free paper off the market, and everyone kind of has to move out the risk curve a little bit. That made a lot of sense to me, but and rates, of course, were compressed overall. Well, what do we have in Europe at the beginning of QE? We have 0% interest rates already, and we have the credit markets, we have companies able to borrow at ultra-cheap rates. So in other words, I don't know if there's a lot of potential for direct improvement in those things because they're kind of late to this. And of course, it's been anticipated. So I think it could help on the margins, again, as a gesture that says central banks are going to, you know, are going to do what they can. But I don't necessarily think it means that, you know, those euros directly bolster equity prices. If the stocks go up there, it's because you have a growth response that was probably going to happen to some degree anyway.
Right, right. And things seem to be improving in Europe, as a matter of fact. What do you think about the possible credit bubble, the bubbles that are possibly created here? It's interesting, this morning on CNBC, they were talking about auto loans, and auto loans were a little softer than they anticipated, but not by much. We're still over 16 million units. But they're talking about the 5- and 7-year auto loan now. I mean, I can't even imagine it paying off a car over 7 years. But 14% of the loans for automobiles right now are 7-year loans. And, you know, it's different when you're buying a house. You might have some opportunity for appreciation, or at least for a stable price in your home. But you're buying an asset that literally depreciated the second that the tires hit the street when you buy an automobile. Are we creating a bubble in this particular sector, a la the same type of bubble that we've created in housing before?
You know, I think you do. You have similar excesses in terms of lending terms, and you have this similar sales culture that's getting those kind of cheap and maybe kind of, you know, hard to justify loans into people's hands. But the reason it can't, in my mind, become the systemic problem that mortgages became is the size of it. It just isn't that big, even though there's a lot of loans being made. You know, Mike Jackson, the AutoNation CEO, mentioned this on CNBC today, too. The outstanding balance has basically been steady. So it's kind of like there's a constant roll and a constant churn in auto loans. And the second reason, not only is the market just not that huge, but even though these loans are maybe kind of questionable in terms of, you know, just whether they make sense, nobody is making a loan on a car expecting the loan to appreciate in value. And nobody's buying a car to flip it, and they're not leveraging themselves with the expectation that the value goes up. That's what was going on in housing. And then the music stopped, and everybody was way over-levered, and the actual collateral value collapsed, and nobody anticipated that. So that's why I don't think you have the same set of assumptions when it comes to cars. The bigger risk to me is, you know, we're in a market where, you know, the loans drive the car sales. And so to the extent the auto industry, you know, has got to keep volumes up at these levels, it only can really happen in this economy at the moment when you have, you know, an aggressive source of cheap auto loans.
Right. And car loans, I guess the car industry right now, I think, is critically important because so many industries have softened a little bit. And when we come back, Mike, if you could just stay with us to the next segment, you wrote a very interesting article, "Where Are the Construction Workers?" I'd like to talk about that and another one that you wrote about high-speed trading, which we've talked a lot about on the show. So stay with us, folks. We'll be back. We've got Michael Santoli with us today. We've got a great show. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to Straight Talk Money. Back in a minute.
The following is a rebroadcast of Straight Talk About Money. The market data in this rebroadcast is not current and should not be used for any financial decisions.
We've got with us today, if you're just joining us, we've got Michael Santoli. Michael, senior columnist for Yahoo Finance. He also appears on the daily ticker in Hot Stock Minute, which is on Yahoo Finance. And on there, he offers his insights on the most important business stories of the day. And that's what we're talking about today. He was 15 years as a columnist you know, feature writer for Barron's Magazine. And so far, he can answer every question I ever wanted to ask. So he's a really bright guy. So, Michael, what do you think of it? You know, much was made of the NASDAQ. I guess it was the last of the three to, you know, to get fully recovered and hit a new high. But it was still interesting in the fact that it, you know, had been many, many years since it had been at 5,000. Is it much ado about nothing? We just kind of hit a number and that's it?
I wouldn't say nothing, but I do think there's more differences than similarities between what the NASDAQ is today and what it was back then. I mean, 15 years as a repair process really is mostly just a reminder of how things were so wild and extreme back then. So the fact that, you know, you had this pretty big sector of the market that was just really in its own world, I think that was the big lesson. And today, really, the NASDAQ is very similar to the rest of the market. It doesn't really exist as a separate realm. You know, I was looking at it, you know, since this bull market started 6 years ago, just about, it's been up about 24% annualized, which is, of course, a great run. But that's the same as the S&P mid-cap stock. So it's kind of just a slightly spicier, growthier version of the broad market. And obviously, everyone's been talking about how the valuations are more reasonable and all the rest of it. But I think what's also interesting is kind of how it fought its way back, which is biotech stocks and non-tech stocks, really, is what took it back in addition to Apple. And so it really wasn't those big winners of 2000 that somehow collapsed and then led it back. It was really a different cast of companies.
How do you feel the market as a whole? I mean, we haven't had a substantial correction since, or even a decent pullback since the fall of 2011. We've obviously been due that for many, many years, and I think people have just got tired of saying it. Do you think we're overpriced? Do you think we're fairly valued? What flavors the porridge to you? Are we okay?
Yeah, I think we're stretching toward the overvalued range, but not in any clear or particularly alarming way. You know, I think it's essentially, look, 20 times trailing earnings. Do bull markets usually top out higher than that? Yeah, they have tended to top out higher than that. So there's stuff left in the tank. I think what's going to be more interesting is what works within the market versus what the overall market does or what it's valued at. Because, you know, if the expectations, let's say, of Fed lifting rates take hold and somehow the bond market starts to, you know, bring yields higher, well, then you have all these bond-like stocks that have done well for a couple of years that have to go down. The consumer staple stocks are very expensive, and they're really just yield plays, and same thing with utilities and REITs and all that. So if those things kind of pull back a lot, the rest of the market could do fine, but the overall index might not necessarily make a lot of headway. So I think a lot of the ingredients are there for this kind of to continue, but you've seen how the momentum is kind of slow. The trajectory of the uptrend is definitely flattened out some. And that makes a lot of sense to me 6 years into a really strong bull market.
Let's talk about the one thing that people are saying that could cause a change in direction of the bull market, and that's interest rates. And, of course, there's been, you and I talked about a little bit during the break, there's been a very lively debate developing lately from some very big names. I guess we entered into this year thinking that rates were almost certainly going to increase. And the question was, would it be in June or would it be in the September meeting? Now there seems to be some doubt in that. And as you mentioned, Charles Evans was coming out saying, well, you know, don't get in such a hurry. We may not need to raise rates at all. And then this morning, a guy named Nomura's Richard Koo, he comes out and he's focusing on the word liftoff, that they think that, you know, that the first rate hike could be a liftoff, and that he said he's drawing the analogy of the liftoff of a rocket. He says, okay, when this thing takes off, you know, they're going to have to, you know, they're really going to start moving it higher. What are your thoughts? Are we going to get a rate increase this year? I guess that's anybody's guess. But what impact do you think that's going to have when that does happen? Because this, you know, the markets historically in my career, the one, you know, they can handle anything as long as they know it's coming. They don't like surprises. Well, you know, a rate increase is certainly not going to be a surprise. We've been beating it to death for probably 2 years now.
That's right. Now, that's been my baseline. In other words, I couldn't tell you what date it's going to happen on, but when it happens, the market will almost certainly be well prepared for it because the groundwork will have been laid and we've been kind of building up this almost fake suspense about it for so long. I do think it's interesting, though, as we get toward these next couple of Fed meetings, as the debate develops. You mentioned you have Charles Evans, the Chicago Fed president, who's been kind of dovish and says, look, inflation is nowhere near a problem. We should wait until it's lifting a little bit before we have to pull rates higher. That's been his role, in a sense, to kind of send that message. But what also intrigues me is you see these very prominent, plugged-in bond fund managers like Bill Gross, like Jeff Gundlach. You've seen also Mohammed El Ariani, who used to be Gross's colleague at PIMCO. And they're all saying, no, we think it's going to happen. And Gundlach's words were, I think they're going to do it just to do it, which is a strange thing to think about. You're going to have the first rate increase in 9 years just because you want to do it. But I think the point being, the time is good enough. The growth figures are good to declare victory and start to build in this process of normalization. But as you mentioned, what's interesting is that you have two parallel debates. One is, when will they start, and then how fast will they go once they start? And that liftoff idea, the idea is, oh, if you wait longer, you're going to have to be quicker. So that's what we don't know. And I think, bottom line, there's enough disagreement among enough smart people that I do think the market is going to have some chop into it, because it's got to adjust to all these varying possibilities until we get to that date. But I'm going to bet September.
Okay, so you're on the side of September. I'm on the side of September, yeah. So you and I are on the same side on that one. Yeah. Could I ask you, do you have just a few more minutes, like maybe 3 or 4 minutes to hang over for?
Sure.
Because I want to talk about this high-speed trading that you talked about. Folks, we're going to talk about the high-speed trading that Michael wrote an article about when we come back. Stay with us. You're listening to Straight Talk Money. Back to you in just a moment.
The following is a rebroadcast of Straight Talk About Money. The market data in this rebroadcast is not current and should not be used for any financial decisions.
Well, if you're a frequent listener, you know I rarely do this, but I rarely have a guest with as much knowledge and such a breadth of knowledge as I have today. So I've been pleased today to have with us Mr. Michael Santoli, senior columnist for Yahoo Finance. And I just couldn't let him go before we talked about one thing, because we've talked several times on the show about high-frequency trading. In fact, we've had some guests bring that up, and what a negative it is for just overall market, for capitalism in general. There's been all kinds of things said about high-frequency trading. But Michael wrote an article, said, forget Flash Boys, which actually, when that came out last year, you might remember, right, we talked about that book when Michael Lewis wrote the book Flash Boys, that high-frequency traders actually help small investors. Michael, tell us all about this.
Well, they help because they compete intensely to handle small investor orders. Now, what I'm talking about here is small investors who use, let's say, an online broker and just kind of send in a market order. It's faster, cheaper, and more certain than ever in history. And the reason for that is, and people popularly think that high-frequency traders are in the market to front-run you, to kind of get in the way of your trades, right, and to make you pay more or get less for your sales. Well, in fact, when you're a small investor, it's quite the opposite, that essentially the entire industry is built to compete for the privilege of handling your trade. And on average, and my colleagues at Barron's really detailed this statistically this week, on average, they improved the price versus what you saw on the quote when you pressed the buy or sell button. Now, there's all kinds of caveats, which is for very large investors trying to move large blocks of stock, which, of course, are mutual funds that small investors are invested in, it's a nuisance for them because there is some issues there of their information about buy or sell interest getting into the price before they want it to. But that's a different issue, and I think it's always existed. Here's the thing I keep coming back to. Somebody in this market for 150 years was always the highest frequency trader. There were always middlemen who were faster than you, who were trying to get there first, and who had an interest in trying to collect a little bit of a spread in between. The issue is now it's a smaller spread than ever before, and in fact, that's why you've kind of never had it better, even though it seems scary that the robots are kind of running the market.
Yeah, it does seem scary. To the average guy, it does seem scary that the robots are running the market. You also talk about
it used to be guys on the floor who were just sitting there with a no-lose proposition of collecting eighths of a point all day long.
Absolutely.
And you didn't mind it was an eighth of a point. Now you're complaining about a penny or two.
Right.
So an eighth of a point, by the way, is 12.5 cents.
Yeah, I go back to those days of an eighth, and boy, I mean that's real money when they're clipping you for an eighth. In fact, I was clipped in the 70s for a quarter every now and then. So yeah, that was far more painful. In the article, you also talk about something that most people probably don't even know about, which is called spoofing. Can you describe that and what's going to be happening to that? Because that does seem to be bad form. I mean that really does seem to be something that shouldn't take place.
Without a doubt. I mean, there's definitely shenanigans that go on, and those things should be kind of closed off one by one without people saying, oh, we have to shut off the machines. And spoofing is essentially having a computer program just systematically throw out fake quotes or quotes that you don't intend to honor, and you're sort of just teasing the other guy's trading algorithm to try to get them to move a stock price or bid on something or offer something and try to catch them and essentially pull them into a trade that's going to be profitable for you. And so because people try to exploit the tendencies of these trading systems, there's this opportunity out there to essentially bluff in a very, very sophisticated way. And that's the kind of thing I think the regulators say, look, you can't do that. You have to honor quotes. You can't just stuff these quotes down there and hope that you're going to move prices a little bit in your favor. And so that's, you know, one of the reasons I think it's been scary to the average investor is it's very complex. The structure is very kind of distributed. It's not like exchanges are central anymore. And so it's a very rickety system. I mean, we saw with the flash crash that, you know, when you have a lot of people who are involved with a lot of computer firepower, but not an obligation to honor prices, that can make things vulnerable. And I do think that there's too many rule types and too many, you know, different venues where people can kind of try to play. And that stuff, I think, can be tightened up without, you know, us essentially saying that the entire high-frequency trading industry has to be dismantled, because, by the way, it's far less profitable than it was even 5 years ago because it's been so competitive.
Yeah, and I don't think it's going away by any stretch of the imagination. Well, I asked you during the break, what is anything concerned you? You had a great answer, so I thought we would share that with the audience. What concerns you as you look on the landscape of the markets and the economy right now?
I mean, the main thing is just, you know, the path of earnings expectations. We had this rally in February as every single day forecast for earnings went down. Yes, a lot of it was oil and financials. But, you know, that has to change. You can't really have profits entirely roll over. And if it's just currency translation with a strong dollar, it's probably not that bad a thing. So that's just one thing out there. It's going to make the market seem more expensive if we lose some of that earnings support. But then beyond that, it's much more, I think we're at a phase where people, you know, have pockets of risk-taking in the financial markets that, you know, could just blow a hole in something. And I thought it was a possibility when we had oil just tanking in such violent way, and then this huge increase in currency volatility that caught a lot of people offside. And so to me, it's more about, you know, overheated, overconfident, you know, hedge funds and other financial players, you know, kind of throwing something unexpected at a fairly richly priced market, and that could be the excuse for some kind of a gut check as well.
Yeah, I guess it's going to take something. We certainly haven't seen it yet. We've had all kind. We've had, you know, we've had Russia, we have had Iran, we've had ISIS, we've had Ebola. In fact, the biggest thing, I guess, to affect the market in the last 3 or 4 years was the Ebola scare. But yeah. Nothing that would typically trigger a sell-off seems to make any difference. I guess the analogy that we're the prettiest girl at the dance may continue to hold up, that there may not be a better choice out there. What do you think?
That's right, especially in the context of big companies throwing a lot of cash flow at buying back their stock. There's really a genuine shortage of suitable assets for people to buy. People are buying stocks purely for yield more than they have in decades. And so you do have that kind of persistent bid out there just because it seems like, well, geez, it is better than some of the other options. And we do have lots of cheap money out there. And you do have a lot of you know, big institutions that are stumped for finding income, and things like insurance companies. And so you have a price insensitive kind of bid in parts of the market that do seem to keep it supported pretty well.
Yeah. Are you concerned about the insurance companies? I've been doing some research on that. You know, those guys are really up against the wall.
They are. They're hurting. And I think you'd be mostly concerned if you were invested in them, because the returns are just horrible. Now, in terms of them being vulnerable, I don't really think so. I mean, just because they're under such close watch right now. But, you know, the same reason that, you know, pension plans are having trouble funding themselves is the reason that insurance companies are just starved. And so what it means is they have to accumulate more capital and just kind of not be very exciting, profitable businesses. And obviously that could be one area where some of the weaker players do, you know, struggle, and that would not be pleasant for the markets necessarily. But it's pretty tough absent rates going up. I tell you though, if the Fed looks like it's definitely going to move, watch those stocks fly and the regional banks and all the rest of it, because they've really been sort of paying a tax for 0% interest rates for a while.
Any last piece of any last advice for our listeners as we go off the air here?
You know, I just think it's really important right now to have fairly modest expectations about what the market can give you long term. You know, it really doesn't owe us too much in the short term right now. Doesn't mean that, you know, this trend is very strong right now in stocks. But, you know, longer term, we may have to have some give back.
I think that's great advice. Michael, thank you so much for being with us today and sharing the vast knowledge that you have. We really appreciate it. Thank you.
All right. My pleasure. Thanks.
Thank you. All right. Bye-bye. All right, folks. That was a great, great, great show.
He's always a terrific guest.
Really
I watched him at the Money Show, and he was...
He gives great, great advice, and
he's got a good look, good take on.
Yeah,
the
I may have to listen to this show again. Anyway, I hope you have a great day. I hope you make a little money today. But more than anything else, it's just a good day to be alive. So more than anything else, I hope God blesses you and your family.
You have been listening to a rebroadcast of Straight Talk About Money. The market data in this rebroadcast is not current and should not be used for any financial decisions.